Welcome to the Midlife Mistress Podcast, your podcast for inspiration on being bold and saying yes to making the most of midlife.
So, Michelle, welcome. We have with us today my good friend, Michelle Woodward, who's going to help guide us through a very interesting, I hope, conversation about a cultural moment that we're having. And what that is I think if you're, watching what's happening in the world today or in the United States today, there's really a conversation happening about womanhood. What does it really mean to be a woman? What is the purpose of a woman? And for our podcast, what is the purpose of being a midster woman, a middle-aged woman? And I think, Michelle, you're going to have some great insights for us. And before we launch into that, tell us a little bit about what you do.
I'm Michelle Woodward, and I am 64 years old, not ashamed to say how old I am. I'm an executive coach. I work with people all over the world. I worked with people on every continent except for Antarctica. So I'm very anxious to meet a research scientist or a penguin. Those are like, it could be one, either one of those. And just last week, I celebrated the 20th anniversary of incorporating my business. And I have to say, I was 44 when I started the business. I had no idea. I actually thought I would do it for a couple of years while my kids were young, and then I would come back to some big corporate job. But actually, it turned out to be something I'm so well suited to. I've just kept doing it for 20 years. So it's a wonderful job for me.
So I'm hoping your coaching experience, you can help us sort of sort out, how does one find their purpose? And what role does society's expectations about what your purpose is or should be have on how you view yourself?
So often we get very tactical when we think about meaning and purpose. And I'm looking at you, Carmen, because I know your work is all with tactics and strategy. And I think when you think about meaning and purpose, you need to go up to sort of geosynchronous orbit a little bit. You need to think about what is purpose. And after all these years of this work and all the people I worked with and everything that I've studied, I think every human being actually has the exact same purpose. I think we're all here to do good. And I think we find meaning in the way we decide to do good. So a kindergarten teacher could find meaning in doing good by working with those little rugrats, where a venture capitalist could actually find meaning in starting businesses or supporting a specific underserved group or, furthering technology. So I think the purpose is shared and the meaning is individual. And that's where you get tactical.
Why do you think it is that there's so much attention paid to our culture to trying to define purpose for women? And by that, I mean, it kind of goes both ways, right? I mean, you have like this whole movement, women should be and do anything they want to be, and they shouldn't be confined to the home and hearth. And, and it's wrong to sort of view a woman as only a mother, right? But on the other hand, there are plenty of women, as well as men, who think a woman's primary purpose is to be a mother. What's behind all that?
So it wasn't that long ago that we didn't have any options, that our purpose was defined and you really couldn't color outside the lines. Now we have options and options can be a little bit overwhelming. And so we have also societal norms, which it's been in our lifetimes that women couldn't have credit cards. They couldn't own property unless they were a widow. All the prescriptions that we had. And so it's just been, let's just say the last, 60 years, right? That women have had a plethora of options. And sometimes that can be a little overwhelming. And so I think what's happening now is people are exerting their options. And people are like, whoa, I didn't know we had that option. I didn't know we could be. I went to high school with a woman who is an astronaut. And she actually went up to the space station for 6 months, and they launched her the day before she turned 50 years old. And I said to her, what do you mean they let old women into space? And I can't say what she responded because it's a swear word. But so my mother's generation, our mother's generation, had no idea, one, that astronauts would exist, but that someone their daughters knew would be an astronaut.
The thing that's interesting about that, though, is you would think that because there's more opportunity for women, that people would kind of get behind that. What I find fascinating is that there are even women that don't get behind that, to say nothing of the men who can't get behind that.
Have you ever considered that there's no female equivalent to the word provider? there's no, so women say all the time, oh, you know, John is such a great provider, or, you know, I'm so happy I'm married to a great provider. But I think it's like 40% of women today are the primary breadwinners in their home. And I have never heard a man say, I'm so proud of my wife, she's a great provider. So I think we've made a lot of progress in the world, but I don't think that we consider women as providers in the same way we consider men as providers. And I think that's a profound difference. Until we get to the place where a woman can be a provider and talked about and appreciated as a provider just as we do with men, I think we haven't finished the progress. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Oh, I think this is a super complicated subject. And in my own life, you know, my mother actually was the first in her family to finish college and was actually went to night law school when I was a kid and then ended her career as the chief judge of the bankruptcy court. So I had a bit of a different role model from other women of my generation. Most of my friends' moms were stay-at-home moms, but it also created a lot of challenges because, to your point, there was absolutely nobody like that when I was growing up. And then for me, my husband and I have had a very egalitarian marriage where we've sort of hopscotched who makes more money and who's kind of the, quote, the provider. But it's really interesting that you say that because there have been times when I've actually said to him, you're such a great provider. And he's never said that to me. And it doesn't mean he doesn't respect what I do. As a matter of fact, he respects what I do a lot. But I never think of myself that way particularly. And I don't think he would define me as that way. And it's super complicated and it's even super fraught to talk about, yeah. Honestly.
And actually, my mother was an equal provider to my father. And at times, my father's 13 years older. My mom has been the primary provider for them in the later years because they were much younger. I've never heard my dad actually say you're a great provider, but it is known that she is a huge contributor in that way. But I do think most men look at, if they're going to compliment their wife, it is about the way they mother. It is the way they parent. It is the way they nurture, the way they love. I don't think they do look at it as provider or career as much, but that's changing. I think that's changing a lot.
Yeah. Can I add I want to add one thing about that. I will say that I feel very strongly that because of the way the financial piece of it and the equality around my career and my husband's career, I think it's made for a much more egalitarian marriage.
Right.
And that part has been fantastic, at least for me. And I actually think it's great for him too.
I think the younger generation, I would say people under 40, are navigating this in a completely different way.
Totally different.
And I see a lot more tag teaming in spouses and partners. And I think that that's very healthy. It's very healthy for families. It's very healthy if you're like killing it in your job and you want to take a sabbatical for a year and be an at-home parent, regardless of your gender or whatever, that you can be in a partnership that allows that. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's ironic because my mother's parents were sharecroppers in West Texas. And the irony of that situation was that because they lived so close to the poverty line, they were absolutely equal partners because literally if you weren't, you might starve. And so it was an interesting construct because my mother would always say to me when I was growing up, I grew up in middle Georgia, and you know, we'd talk about stay-at-home moms. And my mother was like, you do realize that stay-at-home motherhood is a luxury for the rich and the white. And my mother's white. My mother has blonde hair and green eyes. But she was always very clear that that concept was actually not for everybody and never had been. Because Black women always worked and poor women always worked.
And Latinos.
And,
so, right.
And yes, I'm Latino. So, and poor Latino women also always worked. And so I think in my family, there was a very, very strident feminism, and that has absolutely paid off in my marriage because my husband's very respectful of the work that I do and always has been, and also contributed very much. I mean, he was the primary parent in a lot of ways when my kids were growing up, and reflect a lot more what I see from like my daughter and her friends than what I saw among my own peers. I kind of felt like a weirdo when I was rearing children.
You know, it's interesting. You kind of started the conversation talking about doing good and purpose. And you mentioned the kindergarten teacher, and then you mentioned the venture capitalist, both career-oriented to the perspective of you said it, the way you said it. I'm a nurse, and I do feel that I do good through my career, but I find my purpose and my good of doing not even connected to my career. So I think, you know, there's a large landscape there of where people find their purpose and how they find that.
Right. And it may not
general.
Be, it could be through your avocation versus your vocation. And
yeah.
I think especially in your third act, and as a lot of people are contemplating retirement, or what do? And how do you, you know, quote unquote, fill the time, you know, thinking about how can I be of service today? How can I serve my people, my community, my, you know, the causes I care about, and rather than just, you know, sitting back and waiting for your grandchildren, you know, to really go out there and say, how do I make a difference? What can I do?
I think I notice with younger people, so like my daughter's generation, it's almost the opposite. Like they are so focused on whatever they're doing for their career has to be something that they feel really strongly about. I was very lucky because like I got into law because I thought law would be interesting. But I got into prosecution because I did find it had meaning and it had a purpose that I felt good about. But I think that was kind of an accident.
Yeah.
I could easily have been a corporate lawyer and made a lot of money, but been miserable. But like these young people, like they, and especially the young women, they want it all, but not in the way that I did. Like for me, it was like, I have to be both a mother and a professional, right? And have that all. They want a job or a career that combines like the meaning and the purpose, as you said before.
It's interesting because our children's generation, you know, they're a reaction to us as we were a reaction to our parents. It's just the echoes of generations. But they saw us killing ourselves, you know, in the whole sort of greed is good, Gordon Gekko situation. Like, and a lot of us lost our jobs in successive recessions, which is a hard phrase to say. Successive recessions. Got it. But they saw people who missed birthdays, they missed parties, they missed anniversaries. They couldn't come to the soccer practice or the soccer game or whatever. And they saw that and they're like, huh, don't want that for my life. Whereas for, I believe, our generation, that was the norm. And you actually were driven to put your work first. And what I see in coaching and when I come into organizations and I do team coaching is that the boomers or the older Gen Xers who run the place are like, what's up with these kids? They want to finish at 5. They don't want to go the extra mile. And I'm like, no, they saw their parents go the extra mile for no reward.
Work
and so they're
balance.
Not going to do it. Yeah. And, you know, we used to pay lip service. I mean, our generation, lip service to work-life balance. But really, you were expected to work on the weekends, or especially if you're an attorney, mm-hmm. you know, and you've got to work on the weekends. You've got to pull a double shift or whatever you've got to do. And these kids, especially our under 40s, are like, yeah, that doesn't work for us.
I think our children's generation have a very rational response to work in the following way, because I've worked in organizations where people are like, oh, these Gen Zers and these, you know, millennials, they don't work. And I'm like, you know what? We were the suckers because our parents' generation had, to a degree, employment for life. And there was a degree of loyalty from corporations or law firms or whatever. You started somewhere, you stayed for 40 years, you got a gold watch at the end of it and a nice retirement. And our kids realize that's not happening for them. And we sort of were the suckers who kind of went along with that. And then you realize, like, corporation's not watching out for you. I think it's a perfectly rational response on their part.
I think the other thing that is, you know, tipped OKRs, right? But like most organizations now are looking at what's your output? Are you hitting the goals? It's less about how many hours is your butt in the seat. It's like, are the things getting accomplished? I mean, not for a nurse where you have to actually,
right.
But like for a lot of knowledge workers, we've transcended this sort of, you have to give us 8 hours. I always say to the people I coach, if somebody can give you quality product in 6 hours that would take somebody else 20 hours, let them go. You know, let them do their time.
Activity does
right?
matter.
And so these young people, too, are like, tell me specifically what you want me to do. I will deliver that. And then I'm going surfing. And that's, I think, super healthy.
I do, too.
I think the danger from a societal point of view, and this is probably why we're having the cultural moment and some of the conversation that we're having, things that have been reported in the press and so forth, is with that freedom, not just the freedom that women have to do anything they want to do, but work-life freedom, right? Working from home, being more flexible. It makes being a working parent a lot less desirable. And I think you also see, or at least I've seen, that sometimes women who make the choice to not follow the current trend, right, and not seek a career, not become a provider, get looked down on. And, you know, I think it's kind of sad that we as women can't support each other in whatever choice we make. But it's like we move forward, or if you're staying behind, there's something wrong with you. I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one that perceives
that. Oh, I feel that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what we do about that and how we support people that make different decisions than we do.
Am I the only divorced person in the room? Are you? You too? Okay. Hello, sister. I found that when I got divorced, it was really interesting. It was an interesting cultural moment too, because somehow some people that I knew perceived me as a threat, not because I was after their husbands, because that's not me, and I'm a friend of marriage, and I'll be a friend of your marriage and everybody's marriage. But what I think it was a threat to the concept of marriage and the things that we accommodate when we are married. Long marriages have a lot of iterations and a lot of ebb and flow. And I think for some people, in my experience, the idea that I was unpartnered and actually in no hurry to get partnered and actually created a pretty fabulous life unpartnered was staggering and maybe made them a little more introspective than they cared to be. And so for me, like, you know, the thing, the childless cat ladies, you know, kind of aren't contributing to society. I think that there's sort of that, again, a macro consideration, which is what is it like to have a huge quadrant of women who don't have space for a man in their life? And it's not that they have space for a woman in their life, which is fine too. I mean, absolutely fine. They're just absolutely contented as a single person like for me, I have a great circle of friends. I don't care if I ever get married again. It's not even on my radar screen because I have a fabulous life.
You know, it's interesting because one of the biggest influences on me growing up was my aunt, my father's oldest sister, who never married by choice. And I will say that there was a point I said something to my father about it's really my aunt, I have to say, was a little homely looking. And I made a comment that, you know, nobody asked her to get married. And my father's like, what are you talking about? She turned down 3 proposals. She did not want to be married. And it was because in her moment, in her culture, at the time that she was a young woman, she was born in 1910. Wow. It's a long time ago. If you were a woman, you were completely subservient to a man. And I will say that my grandparents' marriage was a very traditional immigrant turn of the century. My grandfather was sometimes a bully. And I think she saw that and decided she didn't want any of it. So she always had her own career and she lived a fabulous life. And I can remember growing up all the invective and criticism that was directed her way from the other women in the family, you know? And I took something completely different from that, which is, wow, like she travels all over the world. That is so cool.
For her to be so strong to be able to embrace that self-identity that was important to her and not let how other people perceive how women's identity should be by being married and having children, I think it's beautiful, especially at that time in life. Today, yeah. It is, you do find a lot of women that feel independent and their self-identity is not wrapped up in another man or raising kids. I don't know that was so prevalent, like when you're, and you've talked about your aunt before, but that was now, not that it is very well accepted. And I even like admire people that go out on their own and do exactly what they want. But I don't know, like you're saying, women at that age, she probably did not have a circle of cheerleaders as women do today. They're empowered.
And we probably didn't hear about a lot of these women either. So I think that maybe in the 1910s and 20s and, you know, these women existed. You only get pieces of their stories by sharing them or going and, you know, visiting Edith Wharton's house and learning about women who were trailblazers in other ways, but they weren't the norm.
And maybe, you know, that's an excellent point, because who controlled how movies were made, or how the olden days, like how radio shows were made, and who wrote them? And now that we have things like this podcast, we have films led by women, directed by women, are more the norm, not as many as we could have. But still, maybe women's stories are being told, which adds to this cultural moment, that it feels maybe a little different, a little more present.
Because all women matter.
It's interesting when you said that the women in the family were not supportive, because I think all of us, to a degree, when somebody makes a different choice from you, there is an element of, you have to make a decision about whether or not you're going to criticize that choice because it's different from yours. And I mean, that's I think that's pretty common. And I think even now, I think about my choices, and I'm thrilled that I had children, and I'm thrilled that I got married. And I also realize a lot of the, I have a very good friend who I'm actually driving to North Carolina to see tomorrow, and she did not get married and she does not have children. My daughter always says, if I don't end up with your life, I want Julia's life.
Oh,
because, and she goes, and I'm not really sure which one I'd pick, because she's like, you've got the husband and the family and the whole deal, but Julia lives a really fantastic life. She's got two houses and she has a full-time job. And then she also runs her little Airbnb empire, and she's got a million friends, and she does this, that, and the other. And so it is there were days when I was like, boy, would I really like to be Julia? And there are other days when I think Julia would be like, I really do wish that I had kids. So I don't know. I mean, I'm speaking for her. I don't know if that's
one of the things that I think we've done so well in probably the last 20, 25 years is that we come to accept alternatives or people's choices that are different from our own. Mm-hmm. I think about all, like when I was coming up, if we, you know, people couldn't come out as gay.
Right.
Right. And now people come out as gay and we're like, dude, great. Do you have a partner? Like, can I meet them? Like, what's the deal? And I think that like has led the way for us to be accepting of other things, how people choose, whether they choose to get married or not get married, whether they choose to have children or not have children, whether they choose to have cats or dogs, you know, all the things. And how wonderful is it that we can have that environment in which we can support everybody in their individual choices that make sense for them and don't hurt anybody.
I think removing judgment is something that I've seen over the last decade. And it's wonderful to see that in society. There's still not enough of it, but removing judgment, you're absolutely right. I think you can embrace people of choices that they make.
There's another aspect of purpose, though, that I think kind of weighs in here, which is the purpose for women, right? And the ways that we can find and achieve what we want has changed so dramatically, but it hasn't for men. So you said before about, like, there's not an analog for, you know, she's such a good provider, he's such a good provider is what we say, right? That's still the role men have, and it's still the way they view themselves. And I don't know how that changes, but it seems to me that for society as a whole to embrace allowing everyone to achieve the purpose that they choose for themselves, both men and women have to be free to do that. And I think that's why a lot of the backlash that you're seeing now against women is being led by men. And I don't think it's necessarily that they're mean-hearted. I think that they just don't understand what is their role if our role has changed.
They've lost their place.
I wrote about this one time, and I'm going to see if I can pull up exactly how I wrote it, but men were kind of told that there was a certain kind of game, and the game was played a certain way, and they all knew the rules, and they knew how to get ahead and how to succeed in that particular game. And then soon, a person of color, or a woman, or a person in a wheelchair came on the sidelines and said, let me play the game. They're like, no, you don't. You can't play the game. We know the rules. You don't know the rules. But if you watch the game long enough, you figure the rules out. And if you get in, if you can just stand on the field, sometimes you can intercept the ball, and sometimes you can run it to the end zone and score. That's what's happened. And there are a lot of men who feel like, hey, you know what? It's our game. It's our rules. I'm not going to let that crazy kid in, you know, like just in the old neighborhood games. And I think that's what we have to do, is we have to find the good men who understand that there is a game being played and let's let everybody on the field. And there are always going to be men who feel like, I have this, I was promised that I was going to be the homecoming king, right? And like, I don't get this, but there are always good men. Your husband is one of those good men,
yes,
that make sure that other people are on the playing field. And I think that's the task ahead.
You know, I think women have done a good job in allowing men to enter a field that maybe they weren't. And what I'm saying about this, and I noticed this probably 20 years ago when I moved up from Texas, because I saw a lot in Northern Virginia in general. But yes, the male is considered the provider and the woman raising the kids. But in this area, I was awakened to the fact so many men showed up for parent-teacher conferences. They were at all the games. They were getting paternity leave. So they are, they're seeing that there is a field open for them. And that's the best for the kids as well. So hopefully both sides will be able to give a little room to each other, mm-hmm, and to support each other, whether it's the provider role or a parenting role. But men have stepped up to parenting. I'm not saying they didn't before, but they were considered the provider and they didn't parent the same way. That's changing.
And you do see stay-at-home fathers, which is like kind of a novelty 20, 30 years ago, but not so much anymore.
Male nannies.
And male nannies.
Yeah.
And babysitters. A manny.
A manny.
I have a client. I have a client who is negotiating this exact moment right now. She is a C-level person, and her husband was this stay-at-home parent just for the trajectory of her career. But their children are grown and flown. Just the last one just went to college, and he's gotten a job, and they're renegotiating their marriage because of he has a job, she has a job, their kids are grown. And it's really interesting to see the way they're turning to each other. Like, there could be a moment where they turned away, right? But they're really consciously turning towards each other, and it's really lovely. She's getting space in her career. She never felt like if she was in a bad job, she couldn't quit because her whole family relied on her. Now she's seeing this space that maybe she could do something else. It's really lovely.
You know, I had the pleasure a few years ago and this is kind of another piece of sort of purpose and choice beyond the male and female role, but marriage and what it is. And in my church, we had briefly had a marriage enrichment ministry that was run by a particular priest who has since moved on. So it kind of moved on with him, unfortunately, because I thought it was actually really great. But we had a day-long retreat, and he invited this woman in, and she does a lot of writing and research and sort of thinking around the area of marriage and what marriage is. And she said, you know, and mind you, she's a priest. So like there is a religious part of marriage, which undeniably, you know, it's a bond, right? It's a sacrament. But she said, you know, you can't walk away from the fact that marriage started out as a commercial transaction, right? I mean, a man would buy the wife to bring her in because he needed to make children to pass on his property, his cattle, whatever it is that he had. And for women, it was a security and safety thing, because as a woman alone, when you couldn't have a job and you couldn't own property and you couldn't have a credit card, you know, going all the way back up until from the beginning of history up until like the 1970s, for a woman, marriage was security and the only way that you could get it. But those twin pillars don't exist anymore. A man doesn't really need to necessarily pass things on to children to be able to have a purpose. And a woman doesn't need to have safety and security through marriage. So what is marriage? And, you know, she sort of posited it as marriage, really modern marriage is really about a mutually supportive environment in which both individual parties through the marriage can find their own personal but also collective purpose.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just a beautiful thought.
I have a friend from college, Mark, and Mark said that he didn't know he was gay until he was like 27. I said, oh, honey, I knew you were gay at 18. Come on. But he has his partner, his husband is named Jim. And I said, what made you guys decide to get married? And he said, we both decided we needed to have someone with us at the end of our life. Mm-hmm. And I actually thought that was one of the most romantic, loving, like, I'm here with you to the end. And I thought, you know, what is marriage if not like that commitment? Like, you know, you will not be alone at the end, unless I go first, probably is what Mark would say. But I think that's a really lovely, lovely sentiment. But I think in this context, too, that we have in America right now, a kind of self-worth through control of women, mm-hmm. I guess, would be the way I would say it in a shorthand. And I think that's kind of antithetical to this future that we've been discussing today. And I don't know how you push back against that in a societal way. I don't know if it's beyond us or we just do our work incrementally in our own field.
That's a good question, and maybe something we can kick around some more on future podcasts.
Yeah.
To think about that.
You know, the other thing we've been talking about is women's roles and so forth. And we've basically been talking about them breaking into a corporate world, being providers and doing more. But talking about postmenopausal women, like even men at the end of, you know, in that stage of life, not much is talked about. They go play golf or whatever. But the cultural conversation about the purpose of women at 50, 60, 70, I'd just like to listen to maybe some of your thoughts about it, because that is another landscape that I think is being re-identified, and our age group is talking about it because we don't feel like it's baked in our DNA to be there just for grandkids or be cat ladies or whatever. So I'd like kind of your thoughts about that.
You know, when you transcend the male gaze, right? Like the idea that women are only viable, you know, they're only juicy when they're viable, right? Or viable when they're juicy. Maybe it's the same thing. But that's from a male perspective. And what we know is that women in their 50s, 60s and beyond are vital and vibrant and making a difference in the world in so many ways. I mean, you think about people who are serving in Congress, people who are serving in the federal government, people who are still working as nurses and teachers and all sorts of things in the later postmenopausal timeframe. And so that's when you extract yourself from that yardstick created in the past for others that you're only viable once you hit 23. I think someone told me once that they thought once they hit 25, that it was all downhill. I'm like, oh my gosh. But, you know, so... are you going to be, you know, externally, you have an external locus of control, which all our therapist friends tell us, or are we going to have that internal locus of control? And I think growth as a human is where we have the internal locus of control and we decide what works for us and how we're going to be. And I would even say with meaning and purpose, right? My children don't have, they're partnered, but they're not having children yet. They're not married yet, but they could still have children anyway, right? But I'm not going to sit around and wait for my grandchildren to be born and to be, and I also can't take for granted my children could decide to not have me as a grandparent. So I can't pine away or imagine some like happy future where I'm surrounded by these loving children, you know, whatever. But I can decide if it's helpful to my children, I can help them with their children. Knowing that the parent-child relationship is the most important relationship, grandparent is secondary. I have to own that. Like, I can't replay my 20s and 30s through my grandchildren. If I can find meaning in helping my own children parent or be there so that they can go on a break, I'm going to do it. And if ultimately I can have a adult-adult relationship, if I live long enough and I, you know, adult-adult relationship with my grandchildren where I can be an advisor, a help, a sounding board, a friend, I'm for it. But I'm also not living my life that's the only eventuality.
There's a couple of things that you've said that I think are really interesting. So that whole thing about moving into menopause, I'm only 52, and so that's very recent for me. And that whole thing about the male gaze is also very, frankly, disconcerting, because you've spent however many years having to react and respond to that. And you're like, huh, I'm slowly disappearing. This is really uncomfortable. And in some ways, I hate it. In other ways, I'm like, thank God I'm done with this. Because I was talking to my daughter about this not long ago. And I was like, from the moment you go through puberty until you come out the other side with menopause, it's almost like you have brain damage because you are genetically programmed to want to have sex at all times, or at least I was, because for whatever, procreation reasons or whatever. And it's like, I feel like I'm getting my brain back in some ways. It's a very interesting thing. The other thing that's happened is I have gone more internal. What do I think about things? And it's happening to me in my personal life and in my professional life. So in my personal life, my husband and I are the main adults in my niece and my nephew's life, but we're not their parents. And it is interesting how, with the benefit of wisdom, they come to us all the time. How do I get car insurance? I'm looking at this job. What do I do about this relationship? Our children do too, but our children are different because they're our children, right? But I'm noticing that with young people, you know, I have a relationship with Mary, with one of Marianne's sons in particular. And it's like, I've gone to coffee with him and he'll ask me what I think about these things. And then on the professional front, it's happening to me as well. So I spent many years as an executive and now I'm a consultant. And I think it's a great transition because I was meeting with a client today who's 18 years younger than I am, and he's a CEO, and there's a lot of things he just doesn't know how to do. And I'm like, oh, well, you do this, this, and this. And he's looking at me like, oh, wow, that's how you do that? So that is also my purpose, is all of a sudden I have this wisdom that I just didn't have 15 or 20 years ago. And I'm not pushing it on everybody, but for people who are interested, I'm like, I'm all in.
Right. I mean, it's funny because I feel like I can do my work for as long as I want, mm-hmm. because the older I get, the more I'm perceived of as a wise woman. And like, I was not perceived of as a wise woman when I was 25. Mm-hmm. And I dig it. It's not bad at all, you know, because my clients, like, they listen, right? They really listen to what I have to say. And I help make a difference in their lives. And to me, that ultimately, as you said earlier, I think it really ultimately comes down to relationship. Mm-hmm. What relationships are you creating and fostering in the world? And what good are you doing in the world? And if you can, at the end of the day, your legacy is, how many people did I help?
That is so inspiring what you said. And it is empowerment. Like, it is very empowering.
So thank you so much, for Michelle, for sharing your wisdom with us tonight.
Thank you.
And I think this is something maybe we will continue to talk about some more. It's an interesting topic and it's, you know, ripped from the headlines. So it's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
For our listeners out there, as always, you can follow us on AmericanMidsters.com. Let us know what you think about this episode and any other episodes.